Audible Inc. presents The Selfish Gene, written by Richard Dawkins, including revisions made to and additional material added for the second edition and the 30th anniversary edition. Narrated by Richard Dawkins and Lala Ward.
Author's note to this audio version. The Selfish Gene was first published in 1976, and the entire text of that is read in this unabridged audiobook. When my publishers approached me suggesting a new edition in the late 1980s, it seemed inappropriate to rewrite completely a book which was a product of its time. So I added two new chapters, plus comprehensive endnotes, to supplement my first thoughts and deal with new developments over the decade or so since the first edition appeared. But endnotes don't work well at the end of an audiobook, so they have for this script been slotted into appropriate points in the original text. To make the switch between original text and endnote clear, I always announce endnote when one starts, and read the whole text of each myself. Lala then resumes reading once the narrative reverts to the original text. It is useful to comprehension if listeners remember that the first edition appeared in 1976 and the endnotes of the second were written in 1989. If I were to revisit the text now, I might well add some of the examples which have burgeoned in the 20 years or so since I wrote the endnotes, but the fundamentals of my arguments have proved pleasingly robust. So I am content to let the main text stand as I wrote it between the years 1972 and 1976. Introduction to the 30th Anniversary Edition. It is sobering to realize that I have lived nearly half my life with the Selfish Gene, for better, for worse. Over the years, as each of my subsequent books has appeared, publishers have sent me on tour to promote it. Audiences respond to the new book, whichever one it is, with gratifying enthusiasm, applaud politely, and ask intelligent questions. Then they line up to buy and have me sign The Selfish Gene. That is a bit of an exaggeration. Some of them do buy the new book, and for the rest, my wife consoles me by arguing that people who newly discover an author will naturally tend to go back to his first book. Having read The Selfish Gene, surely they'll work their way through to the latest, and to its fond parent, Favorite Baby. I would mind more if I could claim that the Selfish Gene had become severely outmoded and superseded. Unfortunately, from one point of view, I cannot. Details have changed and factual examples burgeon mightily. But, with an exception that I shall discuss in a moment, there is little in the book that I would rush to take back now or apologize for. Arthur Kane, late professor of zoology at Liverpool and one of my inspiring tutors at Oxford in the 60s, described The Selfish Gene in 1976 as a young man's book. He was deliberately quoting a commentator on A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth and Logic. I was flattered by the comparison, although I knew that Ayer had recanted much of his first book, and I could hardly miss Kane's pointed implication that I should, in the fullness of time, do the same. Let me begin with some second thoughts about the title. In 1975, through the mediation of my friend Desmond Morris, I showed the partially completed book to Tom Mashler, Doyen of London Publishers, and we discussed it in his room at Jonathan Cape. He liked the book, but not the title. Selfish, he said, was a down word. Why not call it the immortal gene? Immortal was an up word. The immortality of genetic information was a central theme of the book, and immortal gene had almost the same intriguing ring as selfish gene. Neither of us, I think, noticed the resonance with Oscar Wilde's The Selfish Giant. I now think Mashler may have been right. Many critics, especially vociferous ones learned in philosophy, as I have discovered, prefer to read a book by title only. No doubt this works well enough for The Tale of Benjamin Bunny or The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, but I can readily see that The Selfish Gene, on its own, without the large footnote of the book itself, might give an inadequate impression of its contents. Nowadays, an American publisher would, in any case, have insisted on a subtitle. The best way to explain the title is by locating the emphasis. Emphasize selfish, and you will think the book is about selfishness, whereas, if anything, it devotes more attention to altruism. The correct word of the title to stress is gene, and let me explain why. A central debate within Darwinism concerns the unit that is actually selected. What kind of entity is it that survives, or does not survive, as a consequence of natural selection? That unit will become, more or less by definition, selfish. Altruism might well be favored at other levels. Does natural selection choose between species? If so, we might expect individual organisms to behave altruistically for the good of the species. They might limit their birth rates to avoid overpopulation, or restrain their hunting behavior to conserve the species' future stocks of prey. It was such widely disseminated misunderstandings of Darwinism that originally provoked me to write the book. Or does natural selection, as I urge instead here, choose between genes? In this case, we should not be surprised to find individual organisms behaving altruistically for the good of the genes, for example, by feeding and protecting kin, who are likely to share copies of the same genes. Such kin altruism is only one way in which gene selfishness can translate itself into individual altruism. This book explains how it works, together with reciprocation, Darwinian theory's other main generator of altruism. If I were ever to rewrite the book, as a late convert to the Zahavi-Graffon handicap principle, I should also give some space to Amot Zahavi's idea that altruistic donation might be a potlatch style of dominance signal. See how superior to you I am. I can afford to make a donation to you. Let me repeat and expand the rationale for the word selfish in the title. The critical question is which level in the hierarchy of life will turn out to be the inevitably selfish level at which natural selection acts. The selfish species, the selfish group, the selfish organism, the selfish ecosystem. Most of these could be argued, and most of them have been uncritically assumed by one or another author, but all of them are wrong. Given that the Darwinian message is going to be pithily encapsulated as the selfish something, that something turns out to be the gene, for cogent reasons which this book argues. Whether or not you end up buying the argument itself, that is the explanation for the title. I hope that takes care of the more serious misunderstandings. Nevertheless, I do, with hindsight, notice lapses of my own on the very same subject. These are to be found especially in Chapter 1 of the original edition, epitomized by the sentence, "Let us try to teach generosity and altruism, because we are born selfish." There is nothing wrong with teaching generosity and altruism, but born selfish is misleading. In partial explanation, it was not until 1978 that I began to think clearly about the distinction between vehicles, usually organisms, and the replicators that ride inside them. In practice, genes. The whole matter is explained in Chapter 13, which was added in the second edition. In this audio edition, I have deleted that rogue sentence. Given the dangers of that style of error, I can readily see how the title could be misunderstood, and this is one reason why I should perhaps have gone for the immortal gene. The altruistic vehicle would have been another possibility. Perhaps it would have been too enigmatic, but at all events, the apparent dispute between the gene and the organism as rival units of natural selection, a dispute that exercised the late Ernst Mayr to the end, is resolved. There are two kinds of unit of natural selection, and there is no dispute between them. The gene is the unit in the sense of replicator, the organism is the unit in the sense of vehicle. Both are important. Neither should be denigrated. They represent two completely distinct kinds of unit, and we shall be hopelessly confused unless we recognize the distinction. Another good alternative to the selfish gene would have been the cooperative gene. It sounds paradoxically opposite, but a central part of the book argues for a form of cooperation among self-interested genes. This emphatically does not mean that groups of genes prosper at the expense of their members or at the expense of other groups. Rather, each gene is seen as pursuing its own self-interested agenda against the background of the other genes in the gene pool, the set of candidates for sexual shuffling within a species. Those other genes are part of the environment in which each gene survives, in the same way as the weather, predators and prey, supporting vegetation and soil bacteria, are parts of the environment. From each gene's point of view, the background genes are those with which it shares bodies in its journey down the generations. In the short term, that means the other members of the genome. In the long term, it means the other genes in the gene pool of the species. Natural selection therefore sees to it that gangs of mutually compatible, which is almost to say cooperating, genes are favored in the presence of each other. At no time does this evolution of the cooperative gene violate the fundamental principle of the selfish gene. Chapter 5 develops the idea using the analogy of a rowing crew, and Chapter 13 takes it further. Now, given that natural selection for selfish genes tends to favor cooperation among genes, it has to be admitted that there are some genes that do no such thing and work against the interests of the rest of the genome. Some authors have called them outlaw genes, others ultra-selfish genes, yet others just selfish genes, misunderstanding the subtle difference from genes that cooperate in self-interested cartels. Examples of ultra-selfish genes are the meiotic drive genes, which are described later, and the parasitic DNA, an idea which I originally proposed in the first edition, which was developed further by various authors under the catchphrase selfish DNA. The uncovering of new and ever more bizarre examples of ultra-selfish genes has become a feature of the years since this book was first published. Genes in Conflict, The Biology of Selfish Genetic Elements, by Austin Burt and Robert Trivers, arrived too late for inclusion in this edition. It will undoubtedly become the definitive reference work on this important subject. The selfish gene has been criticized for anthropomorphic personification, and this too needs an explanation, if not an apology. I employ two levels of personification, of genes and of organisms. Personification of genes really ought not to be a problem, because no sane person thinks DNA molecules have conscious personalities, and no sensible reader would impute such a delusion to an author. I once had the honor of hearing the great molecular biologist Jacques Monod talking about creativity in science. I have forgotten his exact words, but he said approximately that when trying to think through a chemical problem, he would ask himself what he would do if he were an electron. Peter Atkins, in his wonderful book Creation Revisited, uses a similar personification when considering the refraction of a light beam passing into a medium of higher refractive index, which slows it down. The beam behaves as if trying to minimize the time taken to travel to an end point. Atkins imagines it as a lifeguard on a beach racing to rescue a drowning swimmer. Should he head straight for the swimmer? No, because he can run faster than he can swim and would be wise to increase the dry land proportion of his travel time. Should he run to a point on the beach directly opposite his target, thereby minimizing his swimming time? Better, but still not the best. Calculation, if he had time to do it, would disclose to the lifeguard an optimum intermediate angle, yielding the ideal combination of fast running followed by inevitably slower swimming. Atkins concludes,
"That is exactly the behavior of light passing into a denser medium. But how does light know, apparently in advance, which is the briefest path? And anyway, why should it care?"
He develops these questions in a fascinating exposition inspired by quantum theory. Personification of this kind is not just a quaint didactic device. It can also help a professional scientist to get the right answer in the face of tricky temptations to error. Such is the case with Darwinian calculations of altruism and selfishness, cooperation and spite. It is very easy to get the wrong answer. Personifying genes, if done with due care and caution, often turns out to be the shortest route to rescuing a Darwinian theorist drowning in muddle. While trying to exercise that caution, I was encouraged by the masterful precedent of W.D. Hamilton, one of the four named heroes of the book. In a paper of 1972, the year in which I began to write The Selfish Gene, Hamilton wrote,
"A gene is being favored in natural selection if the aggregate of its replicas forms an increasing fraction of the total gene pool. We are going to be concerned with genes supposed to affect the social behavior of their bearers, so let us try to make the argument more vivid by attributing to the genes, temporally, intelligence and a certain freedom of choice. Imagine that a gene is considering the problem of increasing the number of its replicas, and imagine that it can choose between."
That is exactly the right spirit in which to read much of The Selfish Gene. Personifying an organism could be more problematical. This is because organisms, unlike genes, have brains, and therefore really might have selfish or altruistic motives in something like the subjective sense we would recognize. A book called The Selfish Lion might actually confuse in a way that The Selfish Gene should not. Just as one can put oneself in the position of an imaginary light beam, intelligently choosing the optimal route through a cascade of lenses and prisms, or an imaginary gene choosing an optimal route through the generations, so one can postulate an individual lioness calculating an optimal behavioral strategy for the long-term future survival of her genes. Hamilton's first gift to biology was the precise mathematics that a truly Darwinian individual such as a lion would, in effect, have to employ when taking decisions calculated to maximize the long-term survival of its genes. In this book, I used informal verbal equivalents of such calculations on the two levels. In the following example, we switch rapidly from one level to the other.
We have considered the conditions under which it would actually pay a mother to let a runt die. We might suppose intuitively that the runt himself should go on struggling to the last, but the theory does not necessarily predict this. As soon as a runt becomes so small and weak that his expectation of life is reduced to the point where benefit to him, due to parental investment, is less than half the benefit that the same investment could potentially confer on the other babies, the runt should die gracefully and willingly. He can benefit his genes most by doing so.
That is all individual-level introspection. The assumption is not that the runt chooses what gives him pleasure or what feels good. Rather, individuals in a Darwinian world are assumed to be making an as-if calculation of what would be best for their genes. This particular paragraph goes on to make it explicit by a quick change to gene-level personification.
That is to say, a gene that gives the instruction, "Body, if you are very much smaller than your litter mates, give up the struggle and die," could be successful in the gene pool because it has a 50% chance of being in the body of each brother and sister saved, and its chances of surviving in the body of the runt are very small anyway.
And then the paragraph immediately switches back to the introspective runt.
There should be a point of no return in the career of a runt. Before he reaches this point, he should go on struggling. As soon as he reaches it, he should give up and preferably let himself be eaten by his littermates or his parents.
I really believe that these two levels of personification are not confusing if read in context and in full. The two levels of as-if calculation come to exactly the same conclusion if done correctly. That indeed is the criterion for judging their correctness. So I don't think personification is something I would undo if I were to write the book again today. Unwriting a book is one thing, unreading it is something else. What are we to make of the following verdict from a reader in Australia?
"Fascinating, but at times I wish I could unread it. On one level, I can share in the sense of wonder Dawkins so evidently sees in the workings out of such complex processes. But at the same time, I largely blame The Selfish Gene for a series of bouts of depression I suffered for more than a decade. Never sure of my spiritual outlook on life, but trying to find something deeper, trying to believe but not quite being able to, I found that this book just about blew away any vague ideas I had along these lines and prevented them from coalescing any further. This created quite a strong personal crisis for me some years ago.
I have previously described in Unweaving the Rainbow a pair of similar responses from readers. Although I wrote this in the first person, I have asked Lala to read it for clarity of where these two extracts start and stop.
A foreign publisher of my first book confessed that he could not sleep for 3 nights after reading it, so troubled was he by what he saw as its cold, bleak message. Others have asked me how I can bear to get up in the mornings. A teacher from a distant country wrote to me, reproachfully, that a pupil had come to him in tears after reading the same book because it had persuaded her that life was empty and purposeless. He advised her not to show the book to any of her friends for fear of contaminating them with the same nihilistic pessimism.
If something is true, no amount of wishful thinking can undo it. That is the first thing to say, but the second is almost as important. As I went on to write,
presumably there is indeed no purpose in the ultimate fate of the cosmos, but do any of us really tie our life's hopes to the ultimate fate of the cosmos anyway? Of course we don't, not if we are sane. Our lives are ruled by all sorts of closer, warmer human ambitions and perceptions. To accuse science of robbing life of the warmth that makes it worth living is so preposterously mistaken, so diametrically opposite to my own feelings and those of most working scientists, I'm almost driven to the despair of which I am wrongly suspected.
A similar tendency to shoot the messenger is displayed by other critics who have objected to what they see as the disagreeable social, political, or economic implications of the selfish gene. Soon after Mrs. Thatcher won her first election victory in 1979, my friend Stephen Rose wrote the following in New Scientist.
I'm not implying that Saatchi and Saatchi engaged a team of sociobiologists to write the Thatcher scripts, nor even that certain Oxford and Sussex dons are beginning to rejoice at this practical expression of the simple truths of selfish genery they've been struggling to convey to us. The coincidence of fashionable theory with political events is messier than that. I do believe, though, that when the history of the move to the right of the late 1970s comes to be written, from law and order to monetarism and to the, more contradictory, attack on statism, then the switch in scientific fashion, if only from group to kin selection models in evolutionary theory, will come to be seen as part of the tide which has rolled the Thatcherites and their concept of a fixed 19th century competitive and xenophobic human nature into power.
The Sussex Don was the late John Maynard Smith, admired by Stephen Rose and me alike, and he replied characteristically in a letter to New Scientist, "What should we have done, fiddle the equations?" One of the dominant messages of the selfish gene, reinforced by the title essay of my book, A Devil's Chaplain, is that we should not derive our values from Darwinism, unless it is with a negative sign. Our brains have evolved to the point where we are capable of rebelling against our selfish genes. The fact that we can do so is made obvious by our use of contraceptives. The same principle can and should work on a wider scale. Unlike the second edition of 1989, the anniversary edition adds no new material except this introduction. It does, however, and this is a source of particular joy to me, restore the original foreword by Robert Trivers. I have mentioned Bill Hamilton as one of the four intellectual heroes of the book. Bob Trivers is another. Not only is his foreword a beautifully crafted introduction to the book, unusually, he chose the medium to announce to the world a brilliant new idea, his theory of the evolution of self-deception. I am most grateful to him for giving permission for the original foreword to grace this edition. Richard Dawkins, Oxford, October 2005.
Foreword to the First Edition, written by Robert L. Trivers of Harvard. The chimpanzee and the human share about 99.5% of their evolutionary history, yet most human thinkers regard the chimp as a malformed, irrelevant oddity, while seeing themselves as stepping stones to the Almighty. to an evolutionist, this cannot be so. There exists no objective basis on which to elevate one species above another. Chimp and human, lizard and fungus, we have all evolved over some 3 billion years by a process known as natural selection. Within each species, some individuals leave more surviving offspring than others, so that the inheritable traits, genes, of the reproductively successful become more numerous in the next generation. This is natural selection, the non-random differential reproduction of genes. Natural selection has built us, and it is natural selection we must understand if we are to comprehend our own identities. Although Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection is central to the study of social behaviour, especially when wedded to Mendel's genetics, it has been very widely neglected. Whole industries have grown up in the social sciences dedicated to the construction of a pre-Darwinian and pre-Mendelian view of the social and psychological world. Even within biology, the neglect and misuse of Darwinian theory has been astonishing. Whatever the reasons for this strange development, there is evidence that it is coming to an end. The great work of Darwin and Mendel has been extended by a growing number of workers, most notably by R.A. Fisher, W.D. Hamilton, G.C. Williams, and J. Maynard Smith. Now, for the first time, this important body of social theory based on natural selection is presented in a simple and popular form by Richard Dawkins. One by one, Dawkins takes up the major themes of the new work in social theory. The concepts of altruistic and selfish behaviour, the genetical definition of self-interest, the evolution of aggressive behaviour, kinship theory, including parent-offspring relations and the evolution of the social insects, sex ratio theory, reciprocal altruism, deceit, and the natural selection of sex differences. With a confidence that comes from mastering the underlying theory, Dawkins unfolds the new work with admirable clarity and style. Broadly educated in biology, he gives the reader a taste of its rich and fascinating literature. Where he differs from published work, as he does in criticizing a fallacy of my own, he is almost invariably exactly on target. Dawkins also takes pains to make clear the logic of his arguments, so that the reader, by applying the logic given, can extend the arguments and even take on Dawkins himself. The arguments themselves extend in many directions. For example, if, as Dawkins argues, deceit is fundamental in animal communication, then there must be strong selection to spot deception, and this ought in turn to select for a degree of self-deception, rendering some facts and motives unconscious so as not to betray, by the subtle signs of self-knowledge, the deception being practiced. Thus, the conventional view that natural selection favours nervous systems which produce ever more accurate images of the world must be a very naive view of mental evolution. The recent progress in social theory has been substantial enough to have generated a minor flurry of counter-revolutionary activity. It has been alleged, for example, that the recent progress is, in fact, part of a cyclical conspiracy to impede social advancement by making such advancement appear to be genetically impossible. Similar feeble thoughts have been strung together to produce the impression that Darwinian social theory is reactionary in its political implications. This is very far from the truth. The genetic equality of the sexes is, for the first time, clearly established by Fisher and Hamilton. Theory and quantitative data from the social insects demonstrate that there is no inherent tendency for parents to dominate their offspring, or vice versa. And the concepts of parental investment and female choice provide an objective and unbiased basis for viewing sex differences, a considerable advance over popular efforts to root women's powers and rights in the functionless swamp of biological identity. In short, Darwinian social theory gives us a glimpse of an underlying symmetry and logic in social relationships which, when more fully comprehended by ourselves, should revitalize our political understanding and provide the intellectual support for a science and medicine of psychology. In the process, it should also give us a deeper understanding of the many roots of our suffering.
Preface to First Edition. This book should be read almost as though it were science fiction. It is designed to appeal to the imagination. But it is not science fiction, it is science. Cliché or not, stranger than fiction, expresses exactly how I feel about the truth. We are survival machines, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. This is a truth which still fills me with astonishment. Though I have known it for years, I never seem to get fully used to it. One of my hopes is that I may have some success in astonishing others. Three imaginary readers looked over my shoulder while I was writing, and I now dedicate the book to them. First, the general reader, the layman. For him, I have avoided technical jargon almost totally, and where I have had to use specialized words, I have defined them. I now wonder why we don't censor most of our jargon from learned journals too. I've assumed that the layman has no special knowledge, but I have not assumed that he is stupid. Anyone can popularize science if he oversimplifies. I've worked hard to try to popularize some subtle and complicated ideas in non-mathematical language without losing their essence. I do not know how far I have succeeded in this, nor how far I have succeeded in another of my ambitions, to try to make the book as entertaining and gripping as its subject matter deserves. I have long felt that biology ought to seem as exciting as a mystery story, for a mystery story is exactly what biology is. I do not dare to hope that I have conveyed more than a tiny fraction of the excitement which the subject has to offer. My second imaginary reader was the expert. He has been a harsh critic, sharply drawing in his breath at some of my analogies and figures of speech. His favourite phrases are, with the exception of, but on the other hand, and ugh. I listened to him attentively and even completely rewrote one chapter entirely for his benefit. But in the end, I have had to tell the story my way. The expert will still not be totally happy with the way I put things, yet my greatest hope is that even he will find something new here, a new way of looking at familiar ideas, perhaps, even stimulation of new ideas of his own. If this is too high an aspiration, may I at least hope that the book will entertain him on a train. The third reader I had in mind was the student, making the transition from layman to expert. If he still has not made up his mind what field he wants to be an expert in, I hope to encourage him to give my own field of zoology a second glance. There is a better reason for studying zoology than its possible usefulness and the general likableness of animals. This reason is that we animals are the most complicated and perfectly designed pieces of machinery in the known universe. Put it like that, and it is hard to see why anybody studies anything else. For the student who has already committed himself to zoology, I hope my book may have some educational value. He is having to work through the original papers and technical books on which my treatment is based. If he finds the original sources hard to digest, perhaps my non-mathematical interpretation may help, as an introduction and adjunct. There are obvious dangers in trying to appeal to three different kinds of reader. I can only say that I've been very conscious of these dangers, but that they seem to be outweighed by the advantages of the attempt. Richard Dawkins, 1976. Chapter 1. Why Are People? Intelligent life on a planet comes of age when it first works out the reason for its own existence. If superior creatures from space ever visit Earth, the first question they will ask, in order to assess the level of our civilization, is, have they discovered evolution yet? Living organisms had existed on Earth without ever knowing why for over 3,000 million years before the truth finally dawned on one of them. His name was Charles Darwin. To be fair, others had had inklings of the truth, but it was Darwin who first put together a coherent and tenable account of why we exist. Darwin made it possible for us to give a sensible answer to the curious child whose question heads this chapter. We no longer have to resort to superstition when faced with the deep problems. Is there a meaning to life? What are we for? What is man? After posing the last of these questions, the eminent zoologist G.G. Simpson put it thus.
The point I want to make now is that all attempts to answer that question before 1859 are worthless, and that we will be better off if we ignore them completely.
End note. Some people, even non-religious people, have taken offence at this quotation. I agree that at first it sounds terribly philistine and gauche and intolerant, a bit like Henry Ford's "History is more or less bunk." But religious answers apart, I am familiar with them, save your stamp. When you are actually challenged to think of pre-Darwinian answers to the questions, what is man, is there a meaning to life, what are we for, can you, as a matter of fact, think of any that are not now worthless, except for their considerable historic interest? There is such a thing as being just plain wrong, and that is what, before 1859, all answers to those questions were.
Today, the theory of evolution is about as much open to doubt as the theory that the Earth goes round the sun. But the full implications of Darwin's revolution have yet to be widely realized. Zoology is still a minority subject in universities, and even those who choose to study it often make their decision without appreciating its profound philosophical significance. Philosophy and the subjects known as humanities are still taught almost as if Darwin had never lived. No doubt this will change in time. In any case, this book is not intended as a general advocacy of Darwinism. Instead, it will explore the consequences of the evolution theory for a particular issue. Its purpose is to examine the biology of selfishness and altruism.
Apart from its academic interest, the human importance of this subject is obvious. It touches every aspect of our social lives, our loving and hating, fighting and cooperating, giving and stealing, our greed and our generosity. These are claims that could have been made for Conrad Lorenz's On Aggression, Robert Ardrey's The Social Contract, and Irenaeus Eibel-Eibesfeld's Love and Hate. The trouble with these books is that their authors got it totally and utterly wrong. They got it wrong because they misunderstood how evolution works. They made the erroneous assumption that the important thing in evolution is the good of the species, or the group, rather than the good of the individual, or the gene. It is ironic that Ashley Montagu should criticize Lawrence as a direct descendant of the nature red in tooth and claw thinkers of the 19th century. As I understand Lawrence's view of evolution, he would be very much at one with Montagu in rejecting the implications of Tennyson's famous phrase. Unlike both of them, I think nature red in tooth and claw sums up our modern understanding of natural selection admirably. Before beginning on my argument itself, I want to explain briefly what sort of an argument it is and what sort of an argument it is not. If we were told that a man had lived a long and prosperous life in the world of Chicago gangsters, we would be entitled to make some guesses as to the sort of man he was. We might expect that he would have qualities such as toughness, a quick trigger finger, and the ability to attract loyal friends. These would not be infallible deductions, but you can make some inferences about a man's character if you know something about the conditions in which he has survived and prospered. The argument of this book is that we, and all other animals, are machines created by our genes. Like successful Chicago gangsters, our genes have survived, in some cases for millions of years, in a highly competitive world. This entitles us to expect certain qualities in our genes. I shall argue that a predominant quality to be expected in a successful gene is ruthless selfishness. This gene selfishness will usually give rise to selfishness in individual behavior. However, as we shall see, there are special circumstances in which a gene can achieve its own selfish goals best by fostering a limited form of altruism at the level of individual animals. Special and limited are important words in the last sentence. Much as we might wish to believe otherwise, Universal love and the welfare of the species as a whole are concepts that simply do not make evolutionary sense. This brings me to the first point I want to make about what this book is not. I am not advocating a morality based on evolution. I am saying how things have evolved. I am not saying how we humans morally ought to behave. I stress this because I know I am in danger of being misunderstood by those people, all too numerous, who cannot distinguish a statement of belief in what is the case from an advocacy of what ought to be the case. My own feeling is that a human society based simply on the genes law of universal ruthless selfishness would be a very nasty society in which to live. But unfortunately, however much we may deplore something, it does not stop it being true. End note. Critics have occasionally misunderstood this book to be advocating selfishness as a principle by which we should live. Others, perhaps because they read the book by title only, or never made it past the first two pages, have thought that it was saying that, whether we like it or not, selfishness and other nasty ways are an inescapable part of our nature. This error is easy to fall into if you think, as many people unaccountably seem to, that genetic determination is for keeps, absolute and irreversible. In fact, as we shall see later, genes determine behavior only in a statistical sense. A good analogy is the widely conceded generalization that a red sky at night is the shepherd's delight. It may be a statistical fact that a good red sunset portends a fine day on the morrow, but we would not bet a large sum on it. We know perfectly well that the weather is influenced in very complex ways by many factors. Any weather forecast is subject to error. It is a statistical forecast only. We don't see red sunsets as irrevocably determining fine weather the next day, and no more should we think of genes as irrevocably determining anything. There is no reason why the influence of genes cannot easily be reversed by other influences. For a full discussion of genetic determinism and why misunderstandings have arisen, see Chapter 2 of my book, The Extended Phenotype, and my paper, Sociobiology, The New Storm in a Teacup. I've even been accused of claiming that human beings are fundamentally all Chicago gangsters. But the essential point of my Chicago gangster analogy was, of course, that
knowledge about the kind of world in which a man has prospered tells you something about that man. It had nothing to do with the particular qualities of Chicago gangsters. We could just as well have used the analogy of a man who had risen to the top of the Church of England or been elected to the Athenaeum. In any case, it was not people, but genes that were the subject of the analogy.
I've discussed this and other over-literal misunderstandings in my paper In Defense of Selfish Genes, from which the preceding quotation is taken.
This book is mainly intended to be interesting, but if you would extract a moral from it, read it as a warning. Be warned that if you wish to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly towards a common good, you can expect little help from biological nature. Let us understand what our own selfish genes are up to, because we may then at least have the chance to upset their designs, something that no other species has ever aspired to. As a corollary to these remarks, it is a fallacy, incidentally a very common one, to suppose that genetically inherited traits are by definition fixed and unmodifiable. Our genes may instruct us to be selfish, but we're not necessarily compelled to obey them all our lives. It may just be more difficult to learn altruism than it would be if we were genetically programmed to be altruistic. Among animals, man is uniquely dominated by culture, by influences learned and handed down. Some would say that culture is so important that genes, whether selfish or not, are virtually irrelevant to the understanding of human nature. Others would disagree. It all depends where you stand in the debate over nature versus nurture as determinants of human attributes. This brings us to the second thing this book is not. It is not an advocacy of one position or another in the nature-nurture controversy. If genes really turn out to be totally irrelevant to the determination of modern human behavior, if we really are unique among animals in this respect, it is, at the very least, still interesting to inquire about the rule to which we have so recently become the exception. And if our species is not so exceptional as we might like to think, it is even more important that we should study the rule.
The third thing this book is not is a descriptive account of the detailed behaviour of man or of any other particular animal species. I shall use factual details only as illustrative examples. I shall not be saying, if you look at the behaviour of baboons, you'll find it to be selfish, therefore the chances are that human behaviour is selfish also. The logic of my Chicago gangster argument is quite different. It is this. Humans and baboons have evolved by natural selection. If you look at the way natural selection works, it seems to follow that anything that has evolved by natural selection should be selfish. Therefore, we must expect that when we go and look at the behaviour of baboons, humans, and all other living creatures, we shall find it to be selfish. If we find that our expectation is wrong, if we observe that human behaviour is truly altruistic, then we shall be faced with something puzzling, something that needs explaining.
Before going any further, we need a definition. An entity, such as a baboon, is said to be altruistic if it behaves in such a way as to increase another such entity's welfare at the expense of its own. Selfish behaviour has exactly the opposite effect. Welfare is defined as chances of survival, even if the effect on actual life and death prospects is so small as to seem negligible. One of the surprising consequences of the modern version of the Darwinian theory is that apparently trivial, tiny influences on survival probability can have a major impact on evolution. This is because of the enormous time available for such influences to make themselves felt.
It is important to realize that the above definitions of altruism and selfishness are behavioral, not subjective. I'm not concerned here with the psychology of motives. I'm not going to argue about whether people who behave altruistically are really doing it for secret or subconscious selfish motives. Maybe they are, and maybe they aren't, and maybe we can never know. But in any case, that is not what this book is about. My definition is concerned only with whether the effect of an act is to lower or raise the survival prospects of the presumed altruist and the survival prospects of the presumed beneficiary. It is a very complicated business to demonstrate the effects of behaviour on long-term survival prospects. In practice, when we apply the definition to real behaviour, we must qualify it with the word apparently. An apparently altruistic act is one that looks, superficially, as if it must tend to make the altruist more likely, however slightly, to die, and the recipient more likely to survive. It often turns out on closer inspection that acts of apparent altruism are really selfishness in disguise. Once again, I do not mean that the underlying motives are secretly selfish, but that the real effects of the act on survival prospects are the reverse of what we originally thought. I'm going to give some examples of apparently selfish and apparently altruistic behaviour. It is difficult to suppress subjective habits of thought when we are dealing with our own species, so I shall choose examples from other animals instead. First, some miscellaneous examples of selfish behaviour by individual animals.
Black-headed gulls nest in large colonies, the nests being only a few feet apart. When the chicks first hatch out, they are small and defenceless and easy to swallow. It's quite common for a gull to wait until a neighbour's back is turned, perhaps while it is away fishing, and then pounce on one of the neighbour's chicks and swallow it whole. It thereby obtains a good, nutritious meal without having to go to the trouble of catching a fish and without having to leave its own nest unprotected. More well known is the macabre cannibalism of female praying mantises. Mantises are large, carnivorous insects. They normally eat smaller insects, such as flies, but they will attack almost anything that moves. When they mate, the male cautiously creeps up on the female, mounts her, and copulates. If the female gets the chance, she will eat him, beginning by biting his head off, either as the male is approaching or immediately after he mounts or after they separate. It might seem most sensible for her to wait until copulation is over before she starts to eat him. But the loss of the head does not seem to throw the rest of the male's body off its sexual stride. Indeed, since the insect head is the seat of some inhibitory nerve centres, it is possible that the female improves the male's sexual performance by eating his head. If so, this is an added benefit. The primary one is that she obtains a good meal.
End note. I first learned this odd fact about male insects during a research lecture by a colleague on caddisflies. He said that he wished he could breed caddises in captivity, but try as he would, he could not persuade them to mate. At this, the professor of entomology growled from the front row, as if it were the most obvious thing to have overlooked. Haven't you tried cutting their heads off?
The word selfish may seem an understatement for such extreme cases as cannibalism, although these fit well with our definition. Perhaps we can sympathise more directly with the reported cowardly behaviour of emperor penguins in the Antarctic. They've been seen standing on the brink of the water, hesitating before diving in because of the danger of being eaten by seals. If only one of them would dive in, the rest would know whether there was a seal there or not. Naturally, nobody wants to be the guinea pig, so they wait, and sometimes even try to push each other in. More ordinarily, selfish behaviour may simply consist of refusing to share some valued resource, such as food, territory, or sexual partners. Now for some examples of apparently altruistic behaviour. The stinging behaviour of worker bees is a very effective defence against honey robbers. But the bees who do the stinging are kamikaze fighters. In the act of stinging, vital internal organs are usually torn out of the body and the bee dies soon afterwards. Her suicide mission may have saved the colony's vital food stocks, but she herself is not around to reap the benefits. By our definition, this is an altruistic behavioural act. Remember that we are not talking about conscious motives. They may or may not be present, both here and in the selfishness examples, but they are irrelevant to our definition. Laying down one's life for one's friends is obviously altruistic, but so also is taking a slight risk for them. Many small birds, when they see a flying predator such as a hawk, give a characteristic alarm call, upon which the whole flock takes appropriate evasive action. There is indirect evidence that the bird who gives the alarm call puts itself in special danger because it attracts the predator's attention particularly to itself. This is only a slight additional risk, but it nevertheless seems, at least at first sight, to qualify as an altruistic act by our definition. The commonest and most conspicuous acts of animal altruism are done by parents, especially mothers, towards their children. They may incubate them, either in nests or in their own bodies, feed them at enormous cost to themselves, and take great risks in protecting them from predators. To take just one particular example, many ground-nesting birds perform a so-called distraction display when a predator, such as a fox, approaches. The parent bird limps away from the nest, holding out one wing as though it were broken. The predator, sensing easy prey, is lured away from the nest containing the chicks. Finally, the parent bird gives up its pretense and leaps into the air just in time to escape the fox's jaws. It has probably saved the life of its nestlings, but at some risk to itself.
I am not trying to make a point by telling stories. Chosen examples are never serious evidence for any worthwhile generalisation. These stories are simply intended as illustrations of what I mean by altruistic and selfish behaviour at the level of individuals. This book will show how both individual selfishness and individual altruism are explained by the fundamental law that I'm calling gene selfishness. But first, I must deal with a particular erroneous explanation for altruism, because it is widely known and even widely taught in schools. This explanation is based on the misconception that I have already mentioned, that living creatures evolve to do things for the good of the species or for the good of the group. It is easy to see how this idea got its start in biology. Much of an animal's life is devoted to reproduction, and most of the acts of altruistic self-sacrifice that are observed in nature are performed by parents towards their young. Perpetuation of the species is a common euphemism for reproduction, and it is undeniably a consequence of reproduction. It requires only a slight overstretching of logic to deduce that the function of reproduction is to perpetuate the species. From this, it is but a further short, false step to conclude that animals will in general behave in such a way as to favour the perpetuation of the species. Altruism towards fellow members of the species seems to follow. This line of thought can be put into vaguely Darwinian terms. Evolution works by natural selection, and natural selection means the differential survival of the fittest. But are we talking about the fittest individuals, the fittest races, the fittest species, or what? For some purposes, this does not greatly matter, but when we're talking about altruism, it is obviously crucial. If it is species that are competing in what Darwin called the struggle for existence, the individual seems best regarded as a pawn in the game, to be sacrificed when the greater interest of the species as a whole requires it. To put it in a slightly more respectable way, a group, such as a species or a population within a species, whose individual members are prepared to sacrifice themselves for the welfare of the group, may be less likely to go extinct than a rival group, whose individual members place their own selfish interests first. Therefore, the world becomes populated mainly by groups consisting of self-sacrificing individuals. This is the theory of group selection, long assumed to be true by biologists not familiar with the details of evolutionary theory, brought out into the open in a famous book by V.C. Wynne Edwards and popularized by Robert Ardrey in The Social Contract. The orthodox alternative is normally called individual selection, although I personally prefer to speak of gene selection.
The quick answer of the individual selectionist to the argument just put might go something like this. Even in the group of altruists, there will almost certainly be a dissenting minority who refuse to make any sacrifice. If there is just one selfish rebel prepared to exploit the altruism of the rest, then he, by definition, is more likely than they are to survive and have children. Each of these children will tend to inherit his selfish traits. After several generations of this natural selection, the altruistic group will be overrun by selfish individuals and will be indistinguishable from the selfish group. Even if we grant the improbable chance existence initially of pure altruistic groups without any rebels, it is very difficult to see what is to stop selfish individuals migrating in from neighbouring selfish groups and by intermarriage contaminating the purity of the altruistic groups. The individual selectionist would admit that groups do indeed die out and that whether or not a group goes extinct may be influenced by the behaviour of the individuals in that group. He might even admit that if only the individuals in a group had the gift of foresight, they could see that in the long run their own best interests lay in restraining their selfish greed to prevent the destruction of the whole group. How many times must this have been said in recent years to the working people of Britain? But group extinction is a slow process compared with the rapid cut and thrust of individual competition. Even while the group is going slowly and inexorably downhill, selfish individuals prosper in the short term at the expense of altruists. The citizens of Britain may or may not be blessed with foresight, but evolution is blind to the future.
End note. I must add that the occasional political asides in this chapter made uncomfortable rereading for me in 1989. How many times must this, the need to restrain selfish greed to prevent the destruction of the whole group, have been said in recent years to the working people of Britain? It makes me sound like a Tory. In 1975, when it was written, a socialist government, which I had helped to vote in, was battling desperately against 23% inflation, and was obviously concerned about high wage claims. My remark could have been taken from a speech by any Labour minister of the time. By 1989, Britain had a government of the new right, which had elevated meanness and selfishness to the status of ideology, and my